From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Neil O'Brien. He worked as a missionary priest in the Philippines for over 20 years until he was expelled from the country. He's written a book about his life organizing Christian communities during the Marcos regime. It's titled Revolution from the Heart. Also today, I talk with mystery writer Ed McBain. His latest novel, Tricks, is the 40th book featuring the cops of New York's 87th Precinct. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Stooges, the Detroit band that foreshadowed the British punk groups. And book critic John Leonard reviews Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life by John Conroy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Father Neil O'Brien. 3 years ago, he was expelled from the Philippines, where he had worked for 20 years as a Columban missionary priest. O'Brien, who grew up in South Dublin, worked with the poor on the island of Negros, where virtually the only paid work was on the sugar plantations. In Negros, O'Brien took a strong stand for human rights and nonviolence. And he organized a network of Christian communities which condemned torture, militarism, and the exploitation of the poor. The Marcos regime considered these communities subversive. In 1973, O'Brien was arrested along with two other priests and six lay leaders on trumped-up charges that they murdered a local mayor and his companions. After over a year in prison, O'Brien was released on the condition that he leave the country. He went to a Maryknoll School of Theology in Ossining, New York, for a year of reflection, and there he wrote a book about his experiences in the Philippines and his personal struggle to find a Christian way to oppose violent oppression. The book is titled Revolution from the Heart. It's published by the Oxford University Press. By the way, he returned to the Philippines 10 months ago, after Marcos was overthrown and Corazon Aquino had become president. Father O'Brien, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good evening.
You arrived in the Philippines during the early stages of Vatican II, and it meant coping with all the changes in the church at the same time that you were coping with a completely different culture. And one of the things that you realized after a while in the Philippines was that the primary need in the island where you were wasn't just prayer, it was community. Would you explain that?
Well, with regard to the Vatican Council, of course, I was very excited. I took to it like a duck to water. And immediately I got involved in all the changes of the liturgy into the local language and got myself involved in it. But it also, another thing began to impinge on me, and that was the terrific suffering of the people. Of course, my attitude, even Vatican Council in the early days, didn't seem to talk too much about the poor, actually. It talked about being closer to the world, but it didn't talk about being closer to the poor. But gradually it came across to me that a lot of prayer with no justice is the best formula for atheism in the next generation. And I just felt that without justice, we were wasting our time.
Now, did the Philippines you were working with agree with that or understand it? Because at a lot of the meetings that you went to, everyone would say that their primary need was for a chapel. And there wasn't this sense of organizing Christian communities.
Yes, that took us quite a while to get this point across. And I found that my early days of having a great devotion to the traditional devotions of the church, which I still appreciate, that helped me because I did understand the people's need for prayer. My companion sometimes would be rather paternalistic about this and would feel that the people were wasting their time. On one particular occasion, we were running this seminar and we were asking the people what their needs were. And we were trying to discover their felt needs. Of course, we wanted them to tell us, really, that their needs were proper wages, schooling, health. And they kept getting up and in rags and saying, we need a chapel, we need a place to pray. Finally, one of the nuns who was with me burst out and said, you don't need a chapel, you need proper wages, you need more food. And I was listening at this time, and just as I overheard her, I suddenly realized that we were manipulating the people. We weren't really listening to them. So we held a meeting, and I said, look, we've just got to start listening to the people. If that's what they say is their need, we've got to hear what they say. Now, strangely enough, when we did accept their need, that they wanted a chapel, that they wanted to build a chapel, well, it turned out that the act of building that chapel and collecting together the grass and the reeds and the bamboos necessary was a magnificent act of community and the ideal act for entering into the whole area of community and an ideal act for beginning what we were looking for.
I want you to explain the kinds of communities that you were creating in the Philippines.
I'll explain by telling you a little story. Sure. One time a group came into the convento after our communities were going quite well, and a group came into the convento and said to me, would we start a small Christian community in their area? Now, at this time I was in the upper hand because everybody wanted to start them. So I said, well, look, let me first of all tell you what a small Christian community is. You see this roof, I said. The grass for this roof I got from a strong man who lives way out in a place called Nasalayan. Now, he came in to me the other day about a year after bringing in the grass, and he carried his wife on his back. And as he was walking along the 8 miles that he came in, he had a little child running beside him, holding onto his trousers, and another child carrying a third child. And he came in the 8 miles in the tropical sun. And he told me, he delivered his wife to the door, and she was just a bag of bones. And he looked about 20 years younger than her. And he said to me, he said that they had nothing at all in their house and that they didn't even have a pillow. And at night time, because she found it so hard to sleep, he would stretch out his arm like that and she would sleep on it the whole night. I don't know why he told me that little detail, but it remained with me. And I said to the people, I said, you know, if there had been a Christian community in that village, the men of the community would have carried his wife in on a hammock. The women of the community would have looked after the children and fed them while they went in. And the people of the community would have collected a little money and got some medicine long ago. I said, that's what being a Christian community means. When there's a Christian community, you can lie down at night knowing, I can lie down at night in peace, knowing that old people are being visited, sick people are being helped, and the poor are being fed. And that's what a Christian community is.
You had a revelation that you put down in your book at about the time that you started organizing these Christian communities. You wrote that poverty can be born with patience, but not oppression. That oppression, dealing with oppression, is very different than dealing with poverty.
Yes, you see, poverty, somehow other people can say this is the will of God. They can say that I don't have as much as you have, or that you've got a bigger house than I have. But oppression, injustice means that you feel the sense that it's been taken off you by somebody unjustly. Quite different from something losing it just by an act of fate. Though actually our bishop recently, I heard him say this, and it's germane to what you're saying. Our bishop, Bishop Fortage, he's the man who's had a grenade thrown at him recently. He said that poverty, he says... Some people say the poor you'll have always with you. And the bishop says, yes, I can understand that. Some people have a big car, some have a small and some have none at all. Some have a large house, some have a small house. I can understand that they'll always be poor. But destitution, no, he said. People lacking the very necessities of life, that's not the will of God. That was never in God's plan. And I think it's important to make that distinction between poverty and destitution, between poverty which is unnecessary and poverty which is caused by the greed of others.
This is the kind of thing you really had to work with the people in your communities. For instance, you describe women coming to you with dead babies who they wanted you to bless, and you'd say, well, what killed them? Why did they die? And instead of saying, well, malnutrition or lack of medical care, they'd say, it was the will of God, and this would very much upset you.
Yes, I got, you know, sometimes the sheer total lethargy which had come into the culture, that people would say, this is the will of God. And I would just say quite simply, this is not the will of God. God wants all of us to finish out our years and to go into the grave filled with years and having seen our children's children. And this isn't the will of God. And I must say at that time I had quite a temptation towards I mean, I had an admiration for those who had gone to the mountains and joined the New People's Army, for example, because they at least were standing up. They at least had broken the passivity. And so we spent a lot of time trying to wake people up from the idea that their circumstances were the will of God, were caused by them, and therefore one shouldn't work to change them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the New People's Army. Now, an army of people who decided to fight the Marcos regime with arms. You have always been against violence. You've been for nonviolent. Then you were for nonviolent ways of overthrowing Marcos. What would you say to young men who would tell you that they were going to pick up arms and join the New People's Army to try to end the kind of oppression that they were suffering under?
Oh boy, that wasn't easy because they could easily say back to me, "Well, what are you doing about it?" Because I would admit, if you look at the situation in a place like the Philippines or in many other places, there are only two visible reactions at the moment: passivity, which encourages the oppression and encourages the suffering and the injustice, and is the most common reaction, passivity, and then counter-violence, people standing up and hitting back. And strangely enough, Gandhi says that counter-violence is more dignified than passivity, you know, it's more human. But gradually it was beginning to dawn on me. I knew in my gut that the counter-violence, however justified, it just didn't seem to me to be the thing that Jesus would do. It seemed naive to say that. It seemed being unrealistic. But nevertheless, that was in me. Then eventually, I began to see that there were ways. There were other things. It wasn't just passivity and counterviolence. There was such a thing as active, energetic, assertive, aggressive nonviolence. Revolutionary nonviolence. There were things you could do. And we finally began to do them and to change things without bloodshed.
What was an example of something that you felt you could do that was an assertive act of nonviolence?
Well, there was one particular story where there was a man who was supposed to have killed 27 people in the parish, but certainly he had killed two. And I had reported to the police many times, and they'd done nothing about it to capture him and to take him away. And the people were living in terror. And obviously their reaction was going to be call in the revolutionaries and get him shot. And I felt that would be do no good. It would be still looking for the solution outside themselves. They weren't standing up. And of course, in the basic Christian community, we want people to stand on their own two feet, to stand up and to become human through the process of standing up. So we got together and we met all the Christian communities. What are we going to do? And finally we decided, we will go and visit him. And we will surround the house and we'll say Mass. And we'll invite him to give up his arms. Now, the people would never go on their own. In fact, his house, people used to skirt his house on the road. They wouldn't go near it. So 1,000 of us got together and we came from all directions, a lonely place in the mountains, and arrived at his house. And we said the Mass and I refused him communion and I told him why. And it turned out, of course, that like a child, he handed over all his arms and came with us and gave up what he was doing and told us who was behind him and everything. And I felt it was a terrific victory over fear, which had governed the people, because they felt they could do nothing. They felt the only answer to him was to kill him.
The Catholic, there's a papal statement under Vatican II that said, "Revolution is justified where there is manifest and long-standing tyranny." Now, how did you interpret that for your circumstances?
That's one of the pieces of church teaching that I have difficulty with, in the sense that it's common sense. It's all the mainline churches, the church, the synagogue and the mosque all agree that there are circumstances in which I can kill you. I can kill my brother and sister, or I can drop a bomb on a convent of contemplative nuns. I mean, as was happened in Hiroshima. And a priest blessed the plane. But I have difficulty with that for the same gut feeling, naive idea that Jesus just, this isn't the teaching of Jesus. It's the common sense. It's the just war theory. And that came in around about the 3rd century. The early Christian church did not have the just war theory. Even to join the Roman army, you were excommunicated. And soldiers who became Christians, if you remember, would be executed by the because they'd have to leave the army by the Roman authorities. So a lot of the martyrs were soldiers who became Christians. But in the 3rd century, when Constantine sort of co-opted the church into the system and made the bishops sort of princes and part of the empire, then we became part of the defence of the empire. And Augustine developed the just war theory, those occasions in which a Christian would be allowed to kill. He was very much aware that a Christian shouldn't kill, but now there became exceptions. So I have a lot of trouble with that. But as a priest, I feel that a priest should, he has a sacred duty, I think, to give the people the teaching of the church. I mean, I don't think I have a right to come up with some personal opinion and give it to them. So I always said to people, I go for non-violence, I go for the small Christian communities, and I would take down the Populorum Progressio, and I'd read that little piece that you read. I'd read it, and I translated it into Ilongo, of course. I brought out that encyclical in Ilongo and all the other encyclicals. But then I'd say, look, this is the teaching of the church. If you decide to go to the mountain, you do so without the churches, you are not going against the church. And all I ask you is never have any hate in your heart. But I have chosen a different way. It is a difficult thing, very difficult. I look towards the day when we'll see a gradual disavowment of the just war theory. And I don't think it's that far off.
I want to talk more with you about your work in the Philippines, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Father Neil O'Brien, and he has been based in the Philippines for over 20 years. He was expelled under Marcos, but he went back under Corazon Aquino. He's written a book about his work in the Philippines. It's called Revolution from the Heart. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Father Neil O'Brien is my guest, author of a memoir titled Revolution from the Heart. You started to realize after a while that the kind of basic Christian communities that you were creating were considered very subversive by the Marcos regime. And there's a story you tell in your book, which is the perfect illustration of why they were subversive. And I'd like for you to tell us that story.
Well, you know, my first love is the liturgy. And I got so involved in that actually I was, at one early stage, I was sent letters from Rome in Latin, very formal, asking me to do some experiments with the ceremony of baptism and send my experiment results of my experiments. So I rewrote the baptism service many times. And eventually, as time went on, I began to realize that baptism is at its heart a challenge to people to change the structures, to change the structures of the world. Quite different from the TV evangelist sort of idea that the world is in a terrible place, let's get out of it and to hell with everybody else. Baptism calls us to change the world. Admit it's in a bad state, but to change it. So those famous promises of baptism, I think they're in all, most ceremonies have them. Do you renounce Satan with all his works and with all his pomps? And, I decided that people didn't know what those works and pomps were. Let's name the works and pomps. So why, do you renounce militarization? Do you renounce hunger? Do you renounce torture? And all the things that were happening round about us, I asked people, do you renounce them? And then I would come up with the other ones. Are you willing to stand up and help people who are suffering? Are you willing to stand by those who are being oppressed? Are you willing to oppose injustice? And one day I was giving a mass in just over in the next diocese in a lonely mountain place. And in the middle of the mass, I was, mainly there were mainly women at this mass, and I was in the middle of the sermon when I noticed over the half walls of the little church that we were surrounded by troops in fatigues with machine guns, and the machine guns at the semi-ready. Suddenly I gave a deep breath and everybody in the church sort of froze. I went blank. I said, what did I say last? couldn't. I knew that I had been possibly talking about torture or about militarization or something like that. So then I said, I noticed there are a lot of women here in the church today. And I said, you know, at the first Mass, all the apostles ran away. Only the women remained. Now, they were surrounded by Roman soldiers, armed Roman soldiers. And I'm sure they were afraid. And I'm sure it was quite subversive for them to be in open sympathy with somebody who was a criminal. But they stuck there and they stayed it out in spite of those armed soldiers. And of course, I became like a broken record, but they were getting the message. And as I spoke, the soldiers were moving in. And by the time it came to the end of the Mass, they were right in and looking over the half walls. And I came to the baptism. It was a baptism at the end of the Mass. So I started the baptism, and when I got to the part, do you renounce militarization? Do you renounce injustice? Do you renounce? I don't know what happened, but I suddenly found the words wouldn't come out of my mouth. I said, do you renounce Satan and all his works and all his pomps? And everybody dutifully said yes. Well, to make a long story short, afterwards, when we finally got out of that mess, I was coming home and I said to myself, why did I change? And then I realized I changed because I was afraid. I changed because what I was saying was subversive. And then I said to myself, you know, true religion should be subversive in the sense that it should want to subvert the unjust structures which stop us being the brothers and sisters which we are supposed to be if there is a God as a parent of us all, you know.
Well, you certainly succeeded in being seen as subversive by the Marcos regime. You were not long after this incident happened rounded up, placed under arrest on trumped-up charges of having killed a local mayor, and a deal after over a year in prison, a deal was cut that they would drop the charges if you left the country. And you did, but you came back after Marcos was overthrown. And I'd like to talk with you now about what life is like under Corazon Aquino and if it's changed at all. First of all, are conditions any better? Is day-to-day life any better on the island of Negros?
No, day-to-day life. Well, there's not the fear is gone. In many areas, there is not so much fear as there was in the days of Marcos, and there was certainly, and I would say still is, a lingering hope for change. But the day-to-day life has not changed. But that does not alarm me. I don't expect, after 20 solid years of Marcos digging this enormous hole, that she can fill it up in 18 months. I really think it's unrealistic and it's a fairy tale like understanding of the way the world works to think that she could do that. She's done three magnificent things. She's got him out. She's put in a constitution. She's had what was an election, which even if it wasn't 100% honest, was certainly the most honest we've had in the history of the Philippines. So with that, she has laid the foundations for what could be a stumbling towards democracy.
When you returned to the Philippines, you saw signs up in different places saying, do not support priests and nuns who are communists.
Yes, the military, of course, see the changes as very adverse to them. And they want to get rid of Corazon Aquino with all their heart. So hence all the coups. And they also see the church as a fiscalizer. As the church, of course, changed. For many years, the church was very much on the side of the landowners long ago. But the church has changed. Our bishop now, who comes from a landowning family, now he has stood up for land reform and he's had a grenade thrown at him and his palace burnt down. So, and that we were receiving letters, threats, which say, you know, your days are numbered. And so there's a terrific attack on the priests, and especially any priest who speaks about justice or about land reform. So that has made it very difficult for us at the moment.
Now, another thing that you've noticed about life now under Aquino is that the word nonviolence and all the language of nonviolence has been corrupted by its use from who? From the military.
Well, lots of people who don't want change grab the word non-violence because it seems to them that what they really mean is they don't want any change.
Who are you talking about?
Oh, I'd say it's the military and I'd say the landowners. They sort of say, well, we're against violence. What they mean is we're against the violence of the revolutionaries, but they don't seem to be against the violence of the system, which means that a very wealthy island has thousands and thousands of 100,000 children lining up for soup kitchens to get free soup sent in by generous people in other parts of the world.
And so in their mouths, you think that the word non-violence really means passivity, acceptance?
It means passivity and acceptance. And that means that the non-violence then becomes a dirty word.
So that puts you in a funny position because you, as you always have, still support non-violence. But the language of non-violence is now distrusted by people who think that it's come to mean passivity and acceptance. So what can you do to kind of get the language back?
You've got to rescue the words, and you've got to struggle for it. You've got to struggle to change. But I'll tell you this much: when you examine non-violence, you see, you for example, people will often laugh at the idea of turning the other cheek. But you look at the expression: if he strikes you in one cheek, turn the other. It is an attack on the conscience and the heart of the person who has struck you. It's like saying to them, "Look, I believe you're a human being. Don't act like a brute. I'm giving you the choice. Make a choice again to hit me or not." So you're really a fierce attack on the conscience and the heart. That turning the other cheek is anything but passivity. It is a confronting of the evil.
It must feel ironic to you that Aquino, who is able to come in to power in an incredibly peaceful overthrow, now has to use violence sometimes to stay there. Mm.
Well, it has been really forced on her. I mean, there is a revolution from the left. There is this army which is intoxicated with the power it got. Like, did you ever give a cat meat instead of milk and he'll never go back to the milk? You know, the army doesn't want to go back to the milk, and there's no way they want to give up. So to me, the two extremes live off each other, and she's in the center.
Are you going to stay in the Philippines? You were not born into that life of poverty, and you could leave at some point. How much longer do you think you'll want to stay?
I hope I want to stay always.
So you're committed to staying in the Philippines?
Well, yes. I had a chance to make a change when I was expelled that time. And to change to another mission or maybe to work at home. But somehow or other, I felt that, I feel that where people are crying out for life, where people are calling, God is the God of life. So where people are calling out for life, they're calling out for God. If you're close to them, you'll be close to God in some way. So if I'm staying on there, it's for my own sake, because I feel that they are my key to holiness.
It reminds me of something you say in the book, which is that you realized you didn't have to be the model Christian and offer yourself as the example of perfection. You would learn as much from them as they're from you.
Yes, that has been one of the most beautiful things, to discover that they are the ones evangelizing us, you know, and that if I have anything to say here, it's because I've learned it from them.
I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life in the Philippines. I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, dear.
My guest has been Father Neil O'Brien, who has spent over 20 years now in the Philippines working with the poor on the island of Negros. He was expelled under Marcos, but returned when Corazon Aquino became president. He's written a book about his life and work in the Philippines. It's called Revolution from the Heart, and it's just been published by the Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with magician and sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with mystery writer Ed McBain. He's just completed the 40th book in his series of 87th Precinct police procedurals. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Stooges, the Detroit-based band that paved the way for the British punk groups. And book critic John Leonard reviews Belfast's diary, War as a Way of Life, reporter John Conroy's look at the troubles in Northern Ireland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Another record close on Wall Street today. This time it was a record rise. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 104 points to close at 1842.67. The Dow got some help today from the Federal Reserve Board and two large banks. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan issued a statement today before trading began on Wall Street. He said the central bank was ready to provide liquidity and support to the economic and financial system. Meanwhile, Chemical Bank and Marine Midland Bank cut their prime lending rates by a half point to 9.25%, bringing their prime in line with other top banks. President Reagan today praised both actions.
I'm very pleased and gratified with the action that has been taken so far by the Federal Reserve Board, and the fact that two of the major banks have lowered their interest rates.
Most of the nation's exchanges that trade stock index futures and options suspended activity by late morning. Several resumed trading by late afternoon. The White House today told Congress it expects this year's budget deficit to reach $163 billion. The figure is contained in a report required by the Graham-Rudman Reduction Law. It outlines $23 billion in mandatory budget cuts. The automatic reductions result from the failure of the administration and Congress to reach agreement on a more selective way to reduce the deficit. The cuts go into effect in 30 days if a compromise cannot be worked out. Texas Senator Phil Graham co-sponsored the budget reduction law. He says it would be better to avoid the mandatory cuts.
If we don't take action to try to meet the target through decisions that are made by Congress and the President, that there will inevitably be an effort to come back and repeal the law and restore the spending.
The law this year cuts $11.5 billion from selected domestic and military programs. A military jet crashed a mile short of the Indianapolis International Airport today, plowing into a hotel and exploding in a huge ball of fire. 9 people have been confirmed dead at the 7-story Ramada Inn, and as many as 25 are still missing. The Federal Aviation Administration says the plane was trying to make an emergency landing after an engine flameout when it went down about a mile from the airport. The plane hit a bank building and then slammed into the hotel lobby. The pilot bailed out before the crash and is reported in good condition at an area hospital. President Reagan today hosted Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi at the White House. The two talked in private for about 30 minutes. Officials say one of the topics was India's concern that Pakistan may be trying to build an atomic bomb. NPR's Brian Naylor has details.
The issue of Pakistan and nuclear weapons is a thorny one for the Reagan administration. Most U.S. aid to the Afghan resistance, one of the administration's favorite causes, is funneled through Pakistan. And Pakistan is home to millions of Afghan refugees who have fled the Soviet occupation of their country. But Congress recently cut off U.S. aid to Pakistan because of reports the country is working on a nuclear weapon, which also troubles neighboring India. Prime Minister Gandhi said after his meeting with the president today that his government may have to respond if Pakistan gets the bomb.
Let me assure you, Mr. President, and the people of your country, that we have no intention of producing nuclear weapons unless constrained to do so.
A senior administration official who spoke with reporters after today's meeting said the U.S. regards the Pakistani issue with concern. However, the official added cryptically that there are responsibilities in the region that have to be shouldered. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
A 12th convoy of American-flagged tankers is steaming southwards through the Persian Gulf. The convoy set out from Kuwaiti waters early this morning. In Washington, I'm Anne Bozell.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of the Stooges, a Detroit band that played punk music long before anyone was calling it punk. Their lead singer, who called himself Iggy Pop, wrote songs that were later recorded by David Bowie and others. Ed says Iggy Pop doesn't like it, but he's sometimes called the godfather of punk.
'87 is not only the 30th anniversary of the year rock and roll took over the charts and the 20th anniversary of the Summer of Love, it's also the 10th anniversary of punk rock, if you think punk started in England with the Sex Pistols. But for a lot of us, punk started in 1969 with the Stooges in Detroit singing songs like No Fun.
No fun for my babe. No fun. No fun. No fun. No fun to hang around. Feeling that same old way. No fun to hang around. Freak out for another day.
Detroit in the late 60s was a mess. Racial tension and heroin addiction were at an all-time high, and the city had the dubious distinction of having the highest murder rate in the country. Over in Ann Arbor, the White Panther Party was espousing a curious blend of culture and politics that, unlike hippie philosophy, didn't draw the line at violence. The Vietnam War was pumping plenty of money into Detroit's automobile industry, and bored teenagers cruised Woodward Avenue, radios tuned to rock and roll. The Detroit music scene was really something, too. Kids there liked it loud and nasty, and got it, from the likes of The Up, the Amboy Dukes with lead guitarist Ted Nugent, SRC, the Bob Seger System, the MC5, who are the White Panthers' house band, and, perhaps the nastiest of all, the Stooges.
But can I come over tonight? Or can I come over tonight? What do you think I wanna do? That's right. Can I come over tonight? I said we will have a real cool time tonight. I said we will have a real cool time tonight. So we will have a real cool time.
That was Real Cool Time. The Stooges were different. Whereas other bands tried for flash and virtuosity, the Stooges could hardly play, and they dressed in black leather jackets and jeans. Other bands might write lyrics extolling cosmic brotherhood or revolution, but the Stooges wrote about boredom and how things never changed. Lots of people hated them. But Danny Fields, who hung around with Andy Warhol's crowd and worked at Elektra Records, saw a kind of minimalist genius at work and signed them. The cover of their first album shows four very vacant-looking young men staring out at you. It was enough to inspire instant hatred. My copy was defaced by the Elektra promo man who gave it to me. But that was nothing next to what was in the grooves. Songs like I Wanna Be Your Dog caused outrage across the nation, but the real shock was yet to come. The Stooges toured. Iggy Pop, their lead singer, writhed and smashed the microphone on his head, threw himself into the audience, and occasionally smeared raw meat or peanut butter onto his chest. To an audience deep into Lord of the Rings or Give Peace a Chance, it was way too much. The band splintered in the mid-70s under the pressure of drugs and the extreme way they lived. In 1976, the Sex Pistols started putting out records, the second of which, Pretty Vacant, had a 7-minute version of the Stooges' No Fun on the other side. Today, the Stooges' music is still pretty extreme, but if you believe, as I do, that rock and roll should never get too safe, then you probably haul out your copy of their first album from time to time to relive the good old days of punk.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
A little dollar I can't forget. Smoking on a cigarette. In my life, a real queen. Prettiest thing I ever seen. Uh-huh.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is writer Ed McBain. He's just published his 40th mystery novel in his 87th Precinct series. It's called Tricks, and like the other books in the series, the lead character is not an individual cop, but the entire homicide squad. He's written other novels and screenplays. His most famous novel, The Blackboard Jungle, was made into a popular film. And he wrote the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's thriller The Birds, which he adapted from a Daphne du Maurier story. But those were written under his legal name, Evan Hunter. Ed McBain is a pen name he coined for the 87th Precinct novels. He's also written under the names Hunt Collins and Richard Marston. Actually, his birth name is Salvatore Lambino, a name he abandoned at the beginning of his career because he was told ethnic names didn't sell. Throughout his career, he's used different names for different genres, and he's written in several genres.
When I first began writing, I tried my hand at every sort of fiction that the pulps were publishing. I did westerns and adventure stories and science fiction and sports stories and some detective stories. And I also tried a few what have come to be known as police procedurals, where a policeman or a group of policemen were the heroes. And I decided back then that the only valid people to deal with a crime, especially a crime as serious as murder, were cops. If you come home and find your wife slaughtered in her bed, you don't call the little old lady next door and interrupt her knitting so she can come out and solve the crime as she does in many amateur detective novels. You may call your lawyer, but certainly not to solve the crime. You'll call him to inform you that your wife is dead in bed, and he'll say, "Did you do it?" And if you say no, he'll say, "Then call the police right away. I'll be right there."
You know, I figure one of the big differences between private detective novels and police procedurals is that the private detective has decided to work outside of the system and is usually a loner, whereas in the police novel, they're obviously having to work within the system.
Yeah, even more than that, the cops in the Private Eye novel are the heavies for the most part.
That's right.
Cops would leave the Private Eye alone, he'd have this thing solved in 5 minutes, but they're interrupting him and bothering him, and so he can't get his work done. But I suppose he is a loner. He's not outside the law. You know, Private Eyes are entirely legal, and they have licenses to practice their art. And
they're outside the bureaucracy.
Yeah, and they really are out of their... They're over their heads when it comes to solving murders, because they're not supposed to be solving murders. You know, they're supposed to be... doing skip tracing and adultery cases and insurance frauds and things like that.
There's a police officer in your new novel, Tricks, who really believes that he should retire from police work and start writing best-selling novels. And he's sure he's going to be great. And he says, no one who hasn't been a cop could possibly write good cop novels. Is this a little in-joke here?
Yeah, that's a little in-joke. That's meant to be a comical scene. I think it is a funny scene. That the laziest cop on the squad who never does any work is now talking about writing novels, which is hard work. I think a lot of former cops... With some exceptions, I won't mention any names because I don't like to do that, but some of them are very good and some of them are very bad, and the only thing they have going for them is that they were former cops or former investigators or what have you. It's not so much a matter of writing with these people, it's merely a matter of remembering and putting it down on paper, and that to me is not writing.
The first novel that you wrote that really got national attention was Blackboard Jungle, which was made into a movie of the same name. Now, you taught in a vocational school for a few months when you were young. Is Blackboard Jungle based at all on your experiences as a teacher in New York?
Oh, sure. On my experiences and the experience of other people with whom I had gone to college and who were now teaching in the system and who were bringing home to me atrocity stories about what they were experiencing around the city.
Did you feel that you weren't quite tough enough to handle some of your students?
Tough enough? I felt as if I were a man standing on a street corner throwing gold coins in the air and no one was picking them up. And I worked very hard preparing for class each day, and I would go in, and it was the most shattering experience I've ever had in my life to try to reach these kids and not be able to, because I knew I had something to give them, and I couldn't give it. I was either ill-prepared to do the job or lacking in some other way, but I was unable to reach the kids, and it was a frustrating experience. I would go home at the end of the day, I was almost on the edge of tears. So I guess maybe I wasn't tough enough.
You know, I'll tell you, I haven't read your novel, but I have seen the movie. And my favorite scene in the movie, and I wonder if you wrote this into the novel or not, is the scene where one of the teachers brings in his jazz record collection and wants to play them the Jazzy Blues, Bix Beiderbecke's record, and they shatter his whole record collection. Yeah. And he is just heartbroken.
Yeah,
I think it's such a great scene. Did you write that scene?
Oh, sure.
Did that happen to you or someone you knew?
No, it didn't happen to me. I forget. It happened to someone. It's all very hazy now because that was a long time ago, you know. But I think it happened to a friend of mine who brought his jazz collection to school, and I don't think they broke all the records. I think they broke one of them.
Yeah, in the movie, they break them all because the students think that kind of jazz is really square, and that the only hip thing is rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, you're a jazz pianist, right? Or you used to be?
Oh boy, is that an overstatement?
A hobbyist.
I used to play in a swing band when I was a kid, when I was in my teens, you know. I used to play piano, but really, I am the world's worst piano player. The world's worst. And I no longer even say I play piano. If you know, I never go near it. I just stay far away from it. But you see, that's why you become a novelist, because I wrote Streets of Gold, and the hero of Streets of Gold is a marvelous jazz pianist.
Living out your fantasy through other characters.
Exactly.
Do you ever think of your former vocational students reading your books and thinking, what a heck of a guy, what a tough guy this must be?
I doubt it.
Really?
If I couldn't get them to read then, and I was trying to sell some writers who were a lot better than I, like Shakespeare and that ilk. If I couldn't get them to read Shakespeare, I doubt if they'd be reading me.
Do you ever look back on your early career and say to yourself, it's really lucky I failed as a teacher? Because if you had succeeded as a teacher, you'd probably be a great teacher
and not
a writer.
The education courses I took were only a fallback so that I could earn money while I was writing. I would not be a teacher now if I had not been a writer. I would have been something else, but not a teacher.
This is a question based on your new novel, Tricks. That is something I think that a lot of people with answering machines are going to want to know the answer to. There's a woman who has an answering machine who's getting a lot of threatening phony phone calls. Mm-hmm. And one of the police officers says to her, look, you have to have a very straightforward message on your answering machine because anything cute is going to be...
A come-on.
It's going to be a come-on, to any stranger who calls up.
Yep.
Is that what the story is now?
Well, that's what policemen tell me. It sounds like if you get a caller, you know, an obscene caller, or indeed anyone who's looking to do you harm, either verbal harm or physical harm, and he gets this cute message about hi, and he hears in the background sexy music going or a jazz piano or whatever, and hi, I'm out just now, but I don't want to miss your call, so please be sure to get back to me. You know, he's going to think he's got a real live one there, and he's going to call back, and he's going to catch us sooner or later, or worse. Hi, this is Phyllis. You know, so now he knows her name. And he knows her her phone number, because she's listed in the phone book. And usually her address is listed, too. So he's got, even if she's listed as Jones P, he now knows her name is Phyllis. Phyllis Jones, and he knows where she lives. And it's dangerous. The simplest way to do it is to say, hi, you've reached 1234567. Please leave a message when you hear the beep.
And don't give your name.
And that's it. And anybody who knows your phone number knows it. The guy who got it from the book knows it, but he doesn't know whether there's you living there with a Siberian husky and a brute, or whether it's you living alone, or you living with 12 other people, or the tabernacle choir, or whatever. It's an anonymous message, and he won't bother you anymore.
Well, thanks for the tip. And
okay.
Ed McMahon, thank you very much for talking with us.
And keep a hammer by your bed.
Oh, please. You're kidding, right?
No, I'm serious. That's the police say that's the best weapon for a woman to have.
Really?
Yeah, it's a hammer by the bed, because she knows how to use it, and she won't use it unless the guy is very, very close to her, in which case she will. If she has a gun, she might go berserk, or a knife she won't know how to use, but a hammer she'll know how to use, and she'll know how to use it well.
Ed McBain's new 87th Precinct mystery is called Tricks. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I'm sure you'll be reporting on the latest fluctuations in the stock market.
Oh, boy, will we. We'll be talking with Barbara Mantell about today's developments in the market. Also, we've been checking in all day with a trader on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and following him every couple hours to hear what's been happening. We'll also be hearing from some economists who've been watching things and have some proposed solutions, Elliot Janeway, Milton Friedman, for example, and hearing how a precipitous decline on the stock market, call it crash if you will, affects those of us who don't own big blocks of stock.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Conroy is a Chicago-based journalist who's spent considerable time over the past 10 years reporting from Northern Ireland. He's just written a book called Belfast Diary, War as a Way of Life. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
We don't really want to think about Belfast any more than we want to think about Beirut or any place else where they kill children in God's name, where politics is a disease and religion is terrorism. Certainly John Conroy, a Chicago journalist who's written for most of the respectable newspapers and magazines here and in Canada, hadn't expected to make a career of it when he first went to Northern Ireland in 1977. But he returned in 1980 on an Alicia Patterson Fellowship, and then again each year thereafter, to study how ordinary life adapts to a world of permanent war. He lost his objectivity and found this book. Unlike, say, Joan Didion's visits to El Salvador and Miami, Belfast Diary isn't a work of art. If Didion is a sort of paranoid seismograph registering the tremor of the next psychic quake, Conroy writes instead in blood on bandages. It's visceral. He's there in the Catholic ghetto of Clonard, where they built a wall every bit as ugly as Berlin's, except in Belfast both sides wanted that wall to separate the Christian sects. And still, every time another promise is betrayed, or another hunger striker dies in prison, the garbage bins bang, the petrol bombs fly, buses burn and bandit armies clash by night, and children are shot down on Springfield Road by plastic bullets, and this for Belfast is ordinary, business as bloody usual. It's gone on, of course, for almost 400 years, ever since England sought to subdue its vassal state of Ireland by dispossessing troublesome Catholics and planting the North instead with Scottish Presbyterians. After them, punctuated by potato famines, came Cromwell, William of Orange, the Siege of Londonderry, and the Industrial Revolution. If the English historian Macaulay made too much of Londonderry, the boozy Dublin poets made even more of the pitiful Irish rebellion of Easter 1916, after which North and South were sundered. Before long, in grim Ulster, by 1970, we got an occupying English army and something very much like martial law. Searches without warrant, detention without trial, internment camps, and torture. About the only person in the world today who seems satisfied by the martyr-making machinery in place in Northern Ireland is that Cromwell in petticoats, Maggie Thatcher. But Conroy, who thinks the English should get out but fears a bloodbath if they do so, is impatient with history. His sympathies are personal and particular, not necessarily with the IRA, although he neglects conveniently to mention how many provos were terrorists trained in Libya, and finds excuses for their kneecapping of juvenile delinquents, and certainly not with Ian Paisley and his Protestant paramilitary gangsters, nor with the English Army and the Ulster Constabulary, who shoot at anything they don't understand. But his loyalty and devotion to his landlady and her Catholic neighbors on Springfield Road are absolute. In spite of everything, especially Thatcher, they've survived. To his own numbed surprise, so is Conroy. Although when a mob demands to know his religion in the middle of a riot, he has to keep his lapsed Catholicism secret. He says he is a Jew. In bloody Belfast, as perhaps nowhere else on earth, saying you're Jewish can save your life. Read this book and weep.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed John Conroy's Belfast Diary, published by Beacon Press. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, creators of Raw, the avant-garde magazine of comics and graphics that puts a spin on adult themes like anxiety and despair. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review a new recording of Mahler's Eighth Symphony, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss the overuse of superlatives like world-class and serious. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.